Okay, you're live.
Great. Thank you, Jonathan. We're going to go ahead and open the Hood River City Council. I guess we're calling this a special work session for a presentation by Echo Northwest. And we'll go ahead and get started. And Rachel will do introductions.
Great. Thank you very much, Mayor McBride. The Hood River City Council has long recognized that the cost of housing in Hood River is a burden for many families and community members and makes it difficult for employers to recruit and retain workers. This is one reason why the City Council invested more than $1 million this past year to purchase land at 780 Rand Road to develop affordable housing. The 2021 Council Work Plan includes a project to develop an affordable housing strategy, which would outline various tools available to developers willing to commit to building housing that is affordable to certain income levels. So we are very pleased to have Lorelei Gentinen from Echo Northwest with us to discuss why this is important in a market like Hood River and what things might be included. Lorelei is a partner and project director with Echo Northwest. She specializes in the evaluation of the intersection between public investment and community development. Her recent projects have identified creative approaches to investment in redevelopment and affordable housing for local governments. Many of her recent projects have focused on implementation of equitable housing outcomes, including development of the state of Oregon's first statewide housing plan and affordable housing policies for many Oregon communities. She serves as the vice president of operations for Echo Northwest and will be taking over as president next year. So please join me in welcoming Lorelei. I'll turn it over to her. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rachel. I appreciate that introduction. And I'm really glad to be able to be here tonight, virtually though it is, and to be able to talk about this really important topic. There are definitely situations about Hood River's housing market that make it unique and that make this conversation both more complicated and more urgent for you all. So for tonight, what I would like to be able to do is first just give a little bit of an overview of some indicators of how your housing market is currently performing. My suspicion is that I'm not going to tell you something you don't already know, but maybe we'll put some numbers to it. And then move into a conversation about the role of the public sector in encouraging and supporting development and specifically in housing affordability. It's still the case that the market provides the vast majority of housing, and will continue to do that. So understanding what the market does well and what it doesn't do well is really critical to having a really good, strong, affordable housing strategy. So we'll spend a little bit of time on that. And then touch on some strategies and potential policy solutions, which I imagine will be more of the focus of the discussion once we get through the presentation. So starting with that sort of overview of the housing market. So first I have to, disclose that I'm the kind of nerdy person who at the airport in the olden days when you got to go to the airport would always buy the Harper's magazine with the pure intent of actually reading it, but then only get to the index. And that's all I would read and I'd buy the whole thing just for that. If you're not familiar with the Harper's Index, I love it. It's basically just a list of what feels like random stats, but yet somehow when you get to the end of it, you realize that it tells a full story. So I'm going to attempt a Harper's Index of Hood River's housing market here for you all, and then you can tell me if it works or not. So starting with some information about how incomes and demographics are changing. A couple of indicators here, the percentage of your housing stock that is second homes, the percent of your workforce that actually lives inside of city limits, and then how incomes differ between new and existing residents. So first of all, almost 12% of your housing stock is second homes. We did this analysis with some support from Dustin, looking at utility bills to kind of understand where there were big swings from week to week and month to month. That is a high number. Unfortunately, we don't have a sort of comparable number for other communities to be able to compare to, but this is a noteworthy piece of your housing market. Just 23% of your workforce lives inside of city limits. We did pull that for Ashland and for Redmond, and both of them are in the 30s, so you have a lower percentage. And then last but not least, based on IRS data, new residents are earning about almost $12,000 more than your existing county residents. Okay, so next part, housing underproduction. So one way to start to think about how a housing market functions is whether you're providing enough supply to meet demand. And a simple and straightforward way to think about that is as a ratio to the number of households to the number of units, right? You know you have to have more than one household for every one more than one unit for every household, because you've got vacancy, you've got people moving around, there's demolitions, there's things that are going on. Nationally, the ratio is about 1.14. So for every household, there's 1.14 units. In Hood River, your number is 1.09, so lower than the national average. To help to put that in context and to make sense of that, Oregon is tied for last place for states, literally ranked number 49 for its ratio of households to units, and it's at 1.07 and has one of the worst housing crises in the country. And I also want to put this in the context of thinking about your second home number, which we talked about in the last slide. If we assume that the same portion of new units were second homes and are actually not available to households, your number drops to 1.02. So this is a really strong indicator of underproduction, that you've just don't have supply keeping up with demand, and that it's on par in the best case, on par with what's happening in the rest of Oregon, and in the worst case, really trailing behind. And then the last piece to look at is indicators of affordability. A simple way to think about this is to just compare median increases in sales and rental prices to increases in income. And there you can see that sales prices and rental prices have increased quite dramatically, while median incomes have also increased, which is a good news story, but have not increased sufficiently to actually keep pace with what's happening with the housing stock itself. I want to look at this. I want to dig into the affordability piece just a little bit more. And now I'm failing on my Harper's Index analogy, but we'll continue down this path. Let me help you unpack this graphic just a little bit. So the darker bars, the blue bars here, are showing the percentage of the housing stock that was affordable to folks in this income bin in 2011. So roughly 15% of the housing stock was affordable to people making 80% of median family income in 2011. Roughly, what is that, like 4-5% above 200% of MFI. But by 2019, that had shifted quite substantially, and it had shifted rightward. And you can see that the percentage of housing stock that's affordable to people below 80% of MFI had plummeted to, you know, really it looks like 3-4%. That's not to say that it's not about new construction, it's about your total housing stock, which means that you just have a big chunk of the population who fall into this income bin who are trying to squeeze into fewer and fewer houses that are affordable to them. If we project that forward, it gets even a little bit more dire. So if we just assume that these trends continue and look at what this would look like by 2028, just simple straight line, push them out, you really have very small percentage of your housing stock that's affordable to people even below 100% of median family income by the time you get to 2028. Median family income, just to help to put a number on that and help it make sense to you, is about $70,000 for a family in Hood River. So that means that you've got a pretty significant portion of the population that's really struggling to find housing. So putting that all together, total production is not keeping up. And when that happens, when supply is not keeping up with demand, housing prices rise. And the people who are most affected by that are the people who are in the lower income bracket, and especially renters who experience cost burdening. But increasingly what we're seeing happening in Hood River is that your existing residents are simply getting squeezed out. People who work in Hood River can no longer afford to live there and are moving in other places. Housing affordability is a worsening problem, and it's becoming a challenge for people who currently live in the city to continue to find housing. So that's a quick snapshot of the status of the housing market. Now comes the part where we dig into the details of how developers think about approaching moving forward with new units, so how they think about feasibility, and then what the implications of that are for a public sector role in supporting housing affordability. And I'll ask you to just bear with me through this for a little bit, because it might feel a little bit like we're sort of digging into the details of a development pro forma, but it's helpful context to understand the role that a local government can play in trying to encourage and incent development. So first of all, when a developer is thinking about this, she's going to realize that a lot of stars have to align in order for a development to be able to move forward. You've got to have this sort of magic confluence of this Venn diagram right here in the middle with all four pieces of this happening at once. So starting with public policy, if a developer controls a site, the zoning has to support the use that he or she wants to build on it. The long-range planning has to be in place to allow that site to even be inside of the UGB and served with infrastructure. And then the incentives and exactions like SDCs and other types of fees have to be in alignment with the use of the site. The developer has to control the land, and the land has to be zoned in a way that actually matches with the highest and best use. The developer has to have access to capital. So investors, it is sometimes the case that developers are spending their own money, but oftentimes they are actually investing money from other sources. And those other sources all have their own expectations for return that the developer has to be able to meet. And if the developer cannot meet those expectations, they'll simply go somewhere else. And then without the investment, the development won't happen. So that capital piece is really critical, and the return the drive toward return is not necessarily coming only from the developer. It's coming from the bank, it's coming from other investors. Increasingly, and this may be less the case in Hood River, but in many other places, it's actually pension plans that are investing in development. And so if you have a pension, you might be grateful for the fact that they're seeking the highest return. And then last but not least, the rents have to exceed the construction costs. Rents or sales price have to exceed the construction costs. And if all of those things happen, then development can occur. I want to dig into that last one just a little bit more, rents exceeding costs. That one seems like it's pretty straightforward, but just to make it very explicit, this is an example of a multifamily complex, development complex. So there's some money coming in from the rent, there's some money coming in from the retail. In this case, maybe they're able to charge for parking. All of those revenues together have to exceed the ongoing cost of operating the building, including paying for debt, so covering the cost of construction, which gets operationalized as monthly debt payments, covering vacancy, property taxes, and reserves. And ideally you have that handy little hatched box at the end that's available to create returns or net cash flow. So all of this has to align. You have to control the property, you have to have the correct zoning, you have to have capital, and you have to have this equation that you see on the screen in front of you in alignment for development to occur. I also want to introduce the concept of the housing market continuum. Because this really starts to get into where the market functions well and where it needs some help from the public sector. So what you're seeing here is this is a spectrum from very low income housing on up to at the top luxury housing. The market does a great job of producing at the very top end of this spectrum. For all of the reasons that we just talked about, it's much more likely that rents are going to exceed costs, that you'll be able to get the return that's necessary for your investors, and that the highest and best use will align with zoning at the very top end of the spectrum. And the market does this all day long, and that's normal everywhere. At the very low end, the market is never going to function to build new units on its own that are affordable to folks in the 0 to 30 and really on up into the 50 to 60% of median family income. If you've got market-based housing that's affordable to someone making 30% of MFI, it probably has some pretty serious health, life, safety issues, and is pretty seriously degraded. These are units that are publicly supported, that are rent restricted, and that are usually built with state or federal dollars. And then in the middle is this sort of funny little crossover zone where over time, this luxury construction that the market has built will depreciate in value and might become more affordable to people at the lower end of the or the middle end of the income spectrum, provided that the supply is keeping up with demand, right? So you've got vacancy rates that allow people to move around and enough supply to create housing choice. If all of that happens, a good portion of this sort of middle area here will be met by the market, but over time. And there's some places where construction costs are very high or land costs are very high where that simply can't happen or if supply is not keeping up. And in those situations, the supported environment needs to overlap with the market environment. In Hood River, right now, based on those charts that we were just looking at a minute ago, less than 20% of the housing stock is affordable to those who make less than 100% of MFI. And, you know, median family income is a little bit of a misnomer, but generally you can think about it as the midpoint. About half of your people, half of your citizens are below 100% and about half are over. So you've got roughly half of the people who, families, households that live in the city who are trying to squeeze into 20% of the stock. And that's just not functional. So the supported environment in Hood River, as a result of that, to really meet the needs of these middle income folks, the bar has to extend upward. So takeaways from all of that, thank you for listening to me go through the development 101. The market's gonna take care of the top end. You don't really have to worry about that. I mean, you do absolutely have to have a supportive environment in place. You have to be thinking about placemaking and quality of life. You have to be thinking about getting the regulatory environment set up so that you're not creating barriers to construction because total production really does matter. But for the most part, if you're thinking about proactive investment strategies, the market's going to take care of itself so long as you're not too much in the way. We all know Hood River's land constrained. I don't need to spend a lot of time talking about that, but that almost requires an increase in density to meet the needs of a growing population. And then in addition to that, the market is going to need some help to be able to take care of the middle to lower end. So what does that help look like? Again, thinking about this from a development perspective, from a developer's perspective, and this would apply equally, this construction timeline applies equally to affordable housing and to market rate housing. There are a series of steps that a developer has to go through to get to a place where there's a constructed and operated building. It looks nice and linear here. Oftentimes it actually is not that linear. There's fits and starts and circle backs, but we'll pretend for a minute that it's nice and linear, going from getting a hold of a site and controlling it through permitting, getting your financing all lined up, building it, and then operating the building. So luckily, the public sector's role interfaces with every one of those steps, which does give the public sector a fair amount of leverage. From on the site selection and land control piece, I heard in Rachel's introduction that you all are going forward with purchasing land. So that's one way that you can do that. You also make land available and set the building envelope through zoning, and you make investments in placemaking to help to create neighborhoods where people want to be and that can support good, high quality development. You also provide infrastructure to help to support development. On the project design and permitting piece of it, you pretty much control every aspect of that, including the permitting timeline and design SDC fees. If you've got a design process that you require require developments to go through, that can add costs to that. On the financing side, that typically happens primarily on the private the private side, that's their job. They're very good at figuring out how to fund housing, but grants and loans are a place where the public sector has some leverage. On the construction side, you can very much influence parking costs, again, through your building code and zoning code, as well as infrastructure costs and other aspects of construction. And then last but not least, on the operations side, you can do things like provide tax abatements, or you can influence the total amount of rentable space through the setting of the building envelope. That's a lot to handle in a comprehensive strategy. And there are some of these levers that have more influence than others. Those are the ones that I'm highlighting here in green. Those are the places where you really can have, I mean, all of those levers matter and they all need to be aligned correctly for development to occur. But the ones that really have the biggest influence are the ones that are highlighted here. If you own a site, you get to dictate its future. So good move on buying land. Through the zoning, you determine what the uses are and how big the building can be. If you have access to grants, you can put restrictions and covenants on those grants to help to make sure that you're getting the kind of development outcomes that you want. Parking cost for multifamily specifically is very expensive part of a development pro forma. So reducing the amount of parking that's required can very dramatically help to change the nature of a development pro forma. Infrastructure costs similarly can be very expensive component, especially when you're thinking about a mixed, sort of a larger master planned area. So taking that off of the table in exchange for other kinds of requirements can be very helpful. And then tax abatements and rent subsidies can be really helpful as well. Rent subsidies less so on the actual, you know, sort of getting the building built, but in terms of making sure that you are meeting the needs of lower income residents, providing rent subsidies to help them get access to and into the units can really be a critical part of an overall housing strategy. I made SDCs bold here to remind myself not to forget to talk about them. So I'm gonna have a small SDC diatribe for a minute, and then I'm sure it will be part of our discussion after I'm done talking here. SDCs are probably the number one thing that I get asked about when I'm talking about housing affordability. And the question goes something like, if we increase our SDC fees, will housing prices go up? And the answer to that question is actually pretty nuanced. Sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes the answer is it's even true that if you raise your SDCs too much, the development won't happen. That certainly does occur sometimes, because SDC fees can be quite a significant portion of an overall development pro forma. However, it is not the cost of construction that sets a housing unit's price in the market. It is all of the other comparable units that are on the market that set the price, right? When you are trying to figure out how much to sell, if you're a developer and you're trying to figure out how much to sell a unit for, you don't go, oh, well, my cost of construction was X, so I'm gonna sell for X plus two. You go and look at every other unit on the market and you set your price relative to that. So if the SDC fees don't increase your cost over that sort of market comp, then it's not gonna change your price at all. So it's a pretty nuanced discussion and one that I think requires a lot of attention and intention. You absolutely have to get your SDC fees set at the right level. If they're too high, they can slow development, and total construction is really important. But you know, we need SDCs as a way to be able to pay for infrastructure. And if we don't have that infrastructure, development can't happen. So for the most part, SDCs are not as big of a lever. They don't have as big of an impact on a development pro forma, especially as something like, you know, acquisition or site control or the total amount of rentable area would. So happy to talk about that more later, and I'll step down off my soapbox now. So a quick note about affordable housing. It is a little bit different from what we just went through. The market doesn't build it, which is the number one way in which it's different. All of those policy levers above apply, absolutely apply, and are going to be really helpful in encouraging the development of affordable units, but they may be insufficient. And that really puts you in a place where you have to think about partnerships and resources that you have available to leverage. And I think this would be a really helpful and fruitful place for us to focus the discussion here is who are those partners who are out there, your land trusts, your local housing authority, that can really help to sort of leverage the resources that you're able to bring to the table to fill the gaps in the development pro forma so that affordable housing can move forward. And then what are the resources that you can bring to bear? Are grants a possibility for you? I think you would be hard pressed to offer a low interest loan that's lower than what you can get on the market right now. We are at historically low interest rates. And so there's very little leverage there from a loan. But you know, grants can be incredibly helpful. And in particular, if you control property and can write down the cost of that property, that can make a very big difference. So what does a comprehensive housing strategy look like, especially if your goal is to focus on affordability? We should not underestimate the importance of the market environment, because that total construction, that bringing up that ratio of number of units that are being constructed to the number of folks who are moving into town, is a really critical piece of having, you know, sort of bringing down the price increases. And so the ways that you can think about doing that are through zoning and land supply, which I understand are complicated the fact that you are land constrained, and push us into difficult conversations around density. Parking and infrastructure are really critical components of this. I already spent a lot of time, probably too much time, talking about SDCs and then placemaking. So all of those are really critical and need to be set in the right way to not create barriers to development and to encourage it to occur at the highest rates possible and acceptable. And then when you're thinking about the supported environment, so that's where we're really thinking about building housing units that can be rent restricted and can be available to folks at the lower end of the income spectrum, you need to use your resources to make sure that that's what's being built. So that's where you should be spending your money if you have it, and that's where you should be targeting your incentives to make those things occur. And I guess I'll just say, for probably the fifth or sixth time, land, control the land, and you control the destiny of the site. So I think, yeah, I think that's my flyover of kind of how you think about a comprehensive affordability strategy. And I really wanted to make sure that we left enough time for a good discussion. So I'll pause there and we can go back to any slides if you feel like you want more information. And I'm gonna stop my share now.
Thank you, Lorelei, that was great. We have a hand up already, Megan.
All right, that was super great, but you definitely went fast. And I'm wondering if you can dive a bit more into like what you mean by increasing or changing rental area from our end and placemaking, like what types of things would that look like from the city council end?
So I'm sorry, increasing what?
It was the yield or rentable area.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you. I did fly over that a little bit quickly. So by that, all that means is that because you control your building code and your zoning code, you get to determine how much building envelope there is on any particular site. And the more building envelope there is on any site, the more that you can rent or sell. So you control square footage, basically.
So would that be like height and lot coverage and that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Or okay, thank you. And then placemaking, what do you mean by that?
This is one where Dustin may want to jump in too, since this is like the planner's favorite thing to talk about. That just basically means creating a there, you know, like walkable neighborhood where people want to be, that has a confluence of uses that are attractive, improving streetscapes, allowing for multimodal access to an area, all of those kinds of planning sort of activities and outcomes are ones that are development supportive and can help to encourage development to occur in particular places.
And Lorelei, for that question, one more question on that line. Yeah, are you talking more about just getting more units built, or were you talking about in the affordability range, you know, the lower affordability range, or were you just talking about in general?
I think it's for both. I mean, I think if you're talking specifically about placemaking, I don't think we need different places for people at the lower end of the income spectrum. I think we need high quality places for everybody. And that requires investment and support, whether it's in the market environment or in the supported environment.
Thanks. Mark?
Thanks, Lorelei. This is nice. So I've a couple of questions. The first one, I've heard the placemaking argument mostly used to that we're going to make it too expensive and they can't get affordability. So is there, or is it just artificial?
That we can't have nice things argument.
Right. I personally hope not to believe it, but,
well, let's see. This is a really difficult line to walk. So let's see how I can do it here. Absolutely, there is empirical evidence and support, very strong empirical evidence and support, that places that planners want to produce that are characterized as having a high urban form, high sort of quality urban form, tend to have higher rents and higher sales prices around them. That is just empirically true. Whether you want to use that as an argument for not investing in high quality places or not is kind of up to you. I mean, I think it goes back to the point that I was trying to make just a moment ago, that I think everybody deserves to have access to high quality places where we want to be. So should we be, at the same time that we're investing in making a high quality place with nice walkable built environment, investing in affordable housing right adjacent to it, so that we make sure that everybody has access to those kinds of places. I also think that part of what gets mixed up with this conversation around, really we're talking about gentrification here, is that often planners' ideas of what a high quality built environment is don't match the expectations of the people who are currently living in that community. So there's a sort of heavy-handed government comes in and makes a big investment that improves the place. We know that the consequence of that is that it drives up prices, and the people who live there at that moment are forced out. So I do think you have to be thinking about making those investments very carefully and thinking about the parallel investments in helping to support housing stability, keep people in their homes, rather than displacing them, and also being sensitive to the ways in which you're thinking about placemaking, so that you're not coming in just with, you know, your ideas of what a great place is, but really are engaging the people who live there to make sure that it still feels like home for them.
And then my second question is, do we have good models of Hood River-like places, whether it's in Oregon or not, that we can see these decisions being made, you know, either in recent past or in real time?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could answer that. I have an immediate list of places where it hasn't gone well in my head. I grew up in Idaho, so I spent a lot of time in Haley and Ketchum, Idaho, which are, you know, sort of similar to Hood River in some ways, but proximate to a major resort. And we did some work there not that long ago, trying to help them with an inclusionary housing policy. And that market is bananas. You know, I mean, they have fully missed their window, and Hood River is still in its window. So maybe I would just offer cautionary tales as opposed to examples. Ashland's doing some really interesting stuff. If you're not tracking the conversation that they're having, I think that's another place that you could look. They're trying to do it as proactively as they can, and they're operating in the same land use context and also sort of weird taxation context that Oregon has. You know, our limitations on property tax really create challenges for things like infrastructure funding and sort of box us into a corner with needing to figure out how to pay for infrastructure and sort of force us into a situation where we have to derive a fair portion of that off of development. So there are any number of communities across the state that are grappling with some of the specific questions that you all would be grappling with, like around how you think about funding infrastructure.
Jessica, and then Tim.
Thank you for joining us, Lorelei. And this was all really good information, definitely a lot of good ideas for us. One thing you didn't really touch on is kind of the other end of the spectrum, where I realize most of what we're going to be talking about and trying to focus on is how do we help with the affordable housing. But your statistic about the growth in the second homes is really interesting too. So I don't know if you've seen examples of where tools that have been used to limit that second home. I know, you know, go ahead.
I really didn't mean to interrupt you. I apologize. Oh. But it's very funny because I was just before coming onto this call having a conversation with one of my colleagues who's working in the city of Ashland, and they were asking that exact same question. You know, Hood River is lucky to even know how many second homes you have. I mean, most communities just have no clue. And that's because we don't require any kind of information through our permitting or our taxation process that helps us to understand when a home is a second home versus when it's going to be on the, you know, maybe rented as a short-term rental versus, you know, other kinds of approaches. And I know you all have been proactive on the short-term rental side of things. And I would love to look for a community that was interested in trying to push the envelope a little bit on the second home piece at a minimum to have a better understanding of where they are. That number that I provided is a guess based on utility bills and maybe is probably wrong. So, I mean, at least in some way wrong. So I do think that that's a really important piece of the puzzle. There's also a really important economic development question around the extent to which you want to limit second homes. Obviously, it has a really huge impact on the housing affordability equation. If you've got units that are being produced that are not actually available to people who are working in the community, it means you have to just produce that much more housing. But it's also foundational to your economy. So, you know, it's important to figure out how to balance those out. I don't know the answer to your question. I should have just said that instead of all those other words I just said.
Thank you.
I was just going to follow up with something on the second homes, and then Tim is next. When you did the information on the second homes, did it, I guess I'm just curious about how that was calculated, because, for instance, I know someone that owns about 18 homes here in Hood River, and they're all long-term rentals, and they've been all long-term rentals for over 20 years. But you know, how would you know that? Or how would you know some of them weren't second homes? I mean, I guess it'd be a hard thing to calculate, I would think.
Dustin? Yeah, we wouldn't have captured, Dustin, you should definitely answer this one, but we wouldn't have captured long-term rentals, because if there's someone who's living in the unit, its utility usage isn't going to look significantly different from any other kind of unit. What we're looking for are big swings in utility usage that would indicate that the housing unit was vacant for a period of
time. Oh, the usage. Okay, that's how you're doing it. Okay, I get it. That makes way more sense. Thank you for putting that to make it clear. Thanks.
You want to add anything to that, Dustin?
Yeah, we took we tried to filter it in a couple ways. We looked at the assessor's records to see where first, where the taxes were being sent away from the mailing address, so the tax bill wasn't sent there, and then we layered the utility usage on top of that. So if you qualified under not having your tax bill sent to your house, and we saw a radical seasonal swing from, say, for example, 5,000 gallons used every month in July, and then that dipped to zero in December, we were checking some seasonal usage to try to just filter it out, because there is no true index of, is this your first home, you live here or not? So we tried to pick some criteria to help best guess estimate that.
Great, thanks. Tim?
Thanks, Mayor. Thanks, Laura Lee, for your presentation. It was awesome. I guess I'm gonna ask Mark's question in a slightly different way and then have a follow-up question. It seems like what you're saying is that there's not really any good examples where it's worked correctly. But is there an opportunity to identify specific parts of what people have tried that seem to be more effective than others?
Yeah, and I think that would be a worthwhile road to walk down, is to look at all of those different components of the kind of the way that the public sector intersects with the development process and pull out specific tools, see if they've been used effectively in other places, and then think about how they could be used here in Hood River. I guess I would caution about getting too, we're in such a nuanced and state-specific arena here where our approach to property taxation and infrastructure funding and even development permitting and planning is relatively unique. So a lot of the really good ideas that work in other places may not work well in Hood River or in Oregon, may not work at all without requiring some sort of legislative change. The state recently passed House Bill 2003, which requires cities over 10,000, which I believe you still are not, though you're bumping up against the threshold, to do a new thing called a housing production strategy. And to a certain extent, that's kind of what we're talking about here, is effectively a housing production strategy. DLCD, in the process of doing the rulemaking for House Bill 2003, pulled together a giant compendium of all of the kinds of tools that can be used that would be the right starting place for that kind of a discussion.
Yeah, I think it's going to be useful to, you know, as we go forward, we certainly don't want to be stabbing in the dark at different strategies for sure. So some type of light guidance or something that's going to help us make thoughtful decisions is going to be crucial.
Your biggest and strongest tools are going to be land, cash, and partnerships. You know, everything else is going to be around the edges from there. You might sort of encourage or incent one or two developments, but you're not going to meaningfully move the needle without those, some combination of those three things.
Yeah. So my second question is, and, you know, I appreciated your index approach, and it made things, it gave us a good feel for that there's something that's broke. But I guess I'm trying to get wrap my head around exactly what it is that's broke. Yeah, I'm not sure if you have a feel for that, or can you shed any light on that? Because it seems, obviously, something's not going the way that we want it to. Is there, do you have a feel for what exactly is broke?
I mean, I think part of what you're dealing with is the consequences of your success. I mean, in some ways, you can think about it as it's working too well. Hood River has an amazing quality of place. I love going there. You know, it has really beautiful views. It has an economy that's really thriving. You know, it's going to continue to attract people. To me, it feels like what's not functioning or hasn't happened enough to date, maybe there hasn't been enough urgency or enough push for it yet, is really the focus on the intentional public investment to make sure that housing affordability is invested in. Because without that kind of investment and that sort of intentional movement, your trend is going to continue in the same direction that you're on right now. To a certain extent, I don't think you really want to harness the market or slow it down too much. I don't know that you can. I don't know that forces that are as big as that can really be slowed by the moves that you would make. Like, I often hear people say things like, well, if we just don't allow our zoning to increase, if we don't allow additional density, then nobody will be able to build houses and nobody will move here. But it just doesn't work that way. Basically, what you're doing is you're playing a game of musical chairs, and people have to price qualify to even be able to enter the room to begin the game, right? You know, you have to be thinking about adding chairs and adding spaces, and you have to be thinking about intentionally adding those spaces in a way that will serve the needs of the lowest end of the income spectrum that the market's going to continue to ignore.
Thank you.
Mark, go ahead.
You're muted. I can't hear you, counselor.
Thank you. Sorry about that. In looking at land, cash, and partnerships, that rings true to me too, but it doesn't talk to the missing middle strategy that we've been working on. Is that close second tier? Whereas, I guess we're saying, I hope this is it. That sure is great that we're working so hard on that. So,
yeah, land, cash, and partnerships for your affordable housing pieces.
Oh,
and then get the regulatory environment functional for you for everything else. And I would put the missing middle strategy as a really, really key part of that get the market functional piece. You may need to do some additional work to support missing middle to make sure that in the battle for development uses, missing middle wins. There may need to be some additional work there to make that happen as well. But yeah, no, that's totally critical to the whole first part of the strategy around letting the market do what the market wants to do is you allow the development to happen at all.
Yeah. So in that green section in the middle, that's where that
is. So. Yep.
I think, Lorelei, when you're talking about the missing middle, it's where you were talking about density. You know, because that's what we're talking about with missing middle and trying to balance that line of sense, I call it sense of place, placemaking, and density, you know, making it nice, but also making it dense, making it, you know, next to areas that have greenways and parks, but making it dense enough that more people can move there because it's not a 4,000 square foot house, it's a 1,200 square foot house. So yep. That's what you're talking about with that group that would maybe be in the 100 to 120 area.
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Gladys or Eric? Eric, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mayor. And thank you, Lorelei, for your presentation. It's very interesting. I'm really glad for you to be here today. And the second home concept is also one that has me scratching my head because in some ways, maybe that's the answer to Tim's problem. What's broke? And it's not really broke because in some ways it seems like these second homes are the best thing ever because we have outside taxpayers paying our property tax and paying for our schools and our fire. And so it's maybe a question of the right degree. And I just wondered what tools exist to harness that negative component of them being the buyers of second homes buying too much and driving up prices that we could harness onto and maybe help solve the problem. I mean, something, and this isn't me proposing this, it's just me musing out loud with an expert, but it's like an excise tax, a graduated excise tax to capture at the high end this funds that we could then invest in some kind of public housing. I'm not sure, but I guess what I'm really trying to ask is what tools exist to try to harness revenue from what I think is the problem, and it's a good problem for the reason stated, but the problem of these outside sources coming in, driving up prices, squeezing out our locals. It's complicated because part of what we're doing here is we're defining community. Who is our community? And I think what we're trying to say is our community are the people that are actually here. And while we want to be welcoming for people to come buy second homes, it's a matter of degree. And if they're coming in such waves that we're excluding the folks that are here, I don't know, it seems to me we're defining who our community is on the one hand, but I'm just wondering what tools might exist, whether it's a graduated excise tax or something to try to, if this problem exists, to try to harness a revenue from it to then solve the problem.
Okay, a couple things. First of all, a construction excise tax is absolutely a great idea for you all to be contemplating. In the 2019 or 18, I can't remember, legislative session, the state put in place the opportunity to have a construction excise tax that would create an additional fee that would be available to support affordable housing.
We have that.
You already have that in place. Okay, fantastic. Well, increase it. So you already did that, check. You know, another thing that you can think about is the city of Portland has put in place some incentives that are intended to drive down the size of units that can be built. You know, it doesn't really directly affect affordability, but it might slow down some of the highest end second home purchasers. So that might be something that's worth considering, especially in concert with your your missing middle strategy. So that's another thing to consider. And then last but not least, there's a legislative concept that's working its way through right now. I don't know where it will go, but to restructure the way we do SDCs in the state. Right now, state statute dictates the way that that works. And it's mostly, I mean, it's effectively on a pipe size or per unit basis. Dustin can give you all the details. I'm sure he knows it better than he wants to know it. But the idea is to move towards something that would be graduated based on the size of a unit so that bigger units paid larger SDCs. And another concept would be for it to be based on the real market value. So more expensive ones would pay higher SDCs. Where those go, I don't know, but without legislative reform, your SDCs are dictated by what happens at the state. So that could be another way to sort of extract more money from home buyers to be able to support your local needs. And hypothetically, if you had more money available through your SDCs to be able to support infrastructure funding, that could free up cash in other places.
I think one of the problems that I have noticed, if you just don't have enough inventory, whether it be at the $600,000 range, $800,000, $500,000, all these, what I would call the high range, then if you get something, even if it's smaller, that comes in at the $350,000 range, it gets snapped up so fast, because if it's not deed restricted, they're like, well, I can't get a $500,000 place, so I'll just pay cash for a $350,000 place. And they can outbid and outmaneuver so much faster than anyone else that's, you know, they're because there's not enough inventory, period, they will be snapping up these lesser expensive places if they're not deed restricted. At least I've seen that anecdotally over the last probably 5 years.
I don't know the details of how your local land trust works, but especially for home ownership product, a land trust can be a really, really fantastic partner for that, because they can actually get in there and they can, like the way that the one that functions mostly in the Portland metro area, Proud Ground, works is that they own the land. And then the value of the home itself appreciates, but you only are buying the home, you're not buying the land. So they can maintain affordability over time, because even as people move out of, as you know, sell their homes and move on, the land is still owned by the land trust. And they share, the owners of that home share in the appreciation, because the value of the home itself increases. So they can get in more effectively and it's maintained as affordable over time. So that you know, that's not something a local government can really do. As a municipal corporation, you're not set up to really effectively be able to run a land trust. It's not impossible, but it's not really necessarily a great, you know, it's not something you can just do without a lot of barriers. But if you've got an existing local land trust that you can fund and partner with and make sure that they're as strong and functional as possible, that can be a really critical part of your home ownership strategy.
Great. Additional questions? Megan?
So, you know, clearly one of the big takeaways is cash and land, which in my mind is another form of cash, are the big drivers. And obviously you've talked about, you know, some of our property tax limits and everything. Like, what strategies have other places used to kind of build a better, you know, ball of cash that they can spend on this type of work?
My political will. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it's so simple, but it's really like where you put your priorities and you know, whether you're willing to sort of push through the process enough to make it really happen. The property tax limitations in Oregon are so real, and the infrastructure funding issues are so real. I mean, I do a lot of that kind of work, and I know how limiting those things are. The number of tools that are available to raise additional revenue are limited. So there's levies that you could be thinking about if you are really serious about it, and bonds that would require voter support. And, you know, that's the big strategy that they're pushing hard in the Portland metro area. And if you feel like there's sufficient political will in Hood River, that would be an obvious and fantastic way to go, because then you could raise a pretty substantial stream of revenue that would be available over time, you know, to really make sure that combined with your CET, which can help to fund the operating side of things, could provide you a nice little nest egg.
Well, we've got about 5 minutes till our other next meeting starts. Additional questions for Lorelei? Eric, and then Tim.
So Lorelei, I just want, one of the things we've been talking about is multifamily, and you gave us a lot of reasons why there are obstacles to getting more multifamily. There seems to have been a wave in this area in maybe the 80s, but I wondered, separate from what you've already talked about, are there any specific barriers to private development of multifamily in Hood River that you haven't already spoken about?
A lot of retraction in the current economic environment from investing in multifamily development at all. I think there's just so much uncertainty around COVID and how people are going to go back to the real world. I mean, obviously, that's a very near term right now kind of thing. And if this is a trend you've been seeing for a number of years, it can't all be explained by COVID. But even in really urban markets, you know, there's just that the for sale market, the single family market is through the roof as people are trying to look for additional space for work from home situations. And we're seeing less and less investment in multifamily. So that's certainly part of what's going on.
Tim, did you have a question?
Just really briefly, it's just your comment about identifying partnerships really kind of strikes home with me. That seems like a very important component of this equation, is to reach out and establish those relationships.
Yeah, in the near term, it's going to be a pretty significant challenge to build your way out of this problem. And so partnerships with folks who can help to provide access to housing and rent supports and tenant supports, especially in the near term, that is a really critical part of a comprehensive strategy.
Thank you.
Anyone else have any more? I don't see any. Did you have anything, Rachel?
Mayor, I was just going to wrap it up if it's time to do that.
Yeah, I think I don't see any more questions. Thank you, Lorelei, for your presentation. It's been enlightening. we don't have an easy job here with this subject at all. We've been gathering data on why it's the way it is, and just trying to make some good decisions with some, you know, the middle missing with the zoning. We have this one piece of property we purchased, and we're working on getting some housing on that at some point, hopefully in the near future. And you know, keep using the tools we're using and add on to what we're doing. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
And Mayor, if I could, just to let everybody, the council know, and anyone who's listening, on February 22nd, Mid-Columbia Housing Authority and the new Big River Land Trust will be at the City Council meeting for a presentation. And then we will be putting together kind of a project scope for this affordable housing strategy to bring to council this spring, and we can have more discussion about this. So again, thank you, Lorelei, for your time tonight. We really appreciate it. And just a reminder to the City Council, we have to log in to our next meeting. So thanks very much.
Thank you, everybody. This is important work. So thanks for your attention to it.
Thank you.